All right, authors and TV historians Harry Castleman and Wally Podrajic just released their newest updated edition of their book, Watching TV. Wally, how many pages is the book?
600+.
Wow.
Actually, the question has come up, so how many words are there?
Yeah.
I want to scare people away. About 500,000.
500,000 words. It's a season-by-season narrative that encompasses the eras of American television from the beginning in broadcast through cable and now streaming. And I love this book. And with me, we have Wally and Harry join us to break it all down. Gentlemen, how are you?
Wonderful.
Wow, it sounds like a great book. I've got to go buy it.
It's very heavy. It's a very, very heavy book. I love this book. I was telling Wally once before that there was a book, I think, in the 70s. And I realized this, by the way. This was 82, your first iteration,
yes, right?
Right,
first edition in the early 80s.
And there was an encyclopedia of television with soft cover
that
I just loved because I could page through, and I was a big TV geek back then. But this, I mean, this book has got everything and anything you want to know up to really the 2024, right?
Right, right. The end of the 23-24 season. We take it right through to August, basically, of 24.
I mean, the book you were talking about, which is a wonderful book, Encyclopedia of American Television, it has entries for a lot of shows, you know, alphabetically. And that's great. And that serves a wonderful purpose. Our book is trying something a little different. It's trying to say, okay, there's all these shows out there through TV's history. How do you make any sense of it?
Yeah.
How do you kind of put it in context and tell a story about it? And that's our real hard task, was to take and make an interesting story from all the people and programs through TV history. And hopefully we accomplished that.
I think you did. First of all, I want you guys to tell folks what you both do for a living, because it's all weaved into your love for television. Harry, we can start with you.
Well, Wally and I first met on the shores of Lake Michigan at Northwestern University in the early 70s. We were both working at our college radio station, WNUR, and we got to know each other from a show I was doing about the Beatles, and that's started our Beatle working together, which eventually a couple of years later wound up with our first book, All Together Now, which was a Beatles discography. And then eventually, after a couple of years after that, we wound up watching TV. Meanwhile, I went off to law school, became a lawyer, and worked for 40 years as a lawyer. I guess it all went by kind of quickly. I've recently retired, and so that's, in general, what I've been doing.
And you, Wally?
In my case, in terms of reinforcing the television aspect, I did a lot of work with the political party Democratic National Convention prep, which is less about who is the nominee. I was on the side that was setting it up for coverage. I would be working with the networks and also the print people and the radio people and the photo people and such. So that would help you to, if you're a media person, to do the best job possible covering it. The bonus on that is I always got to see, for like 9 conventions, I got to see what the latest and greatest was, the stuff they wanted to show off technically, and then the personnel they wanted to show off and such. And so that's the most consistent thing I had done over the decades, but also did consulting for other events. And also had some work with the Museum of Broadcast Communication.
Yes, and continue, and will continue. So you also lecture. I mean,
I'm sorry. I teach at the University of Illinois Chicago, and among my courses are, here's a surprise, history of television,
right?
Future TV, media and politics, and even this semester I did communication and music.
Wow!
And the amazing thing about that, even when I say communication and music, it's all through video. It's all through images. And so it is a good corner of the pop culture world to be in when you're talking about television and every form that it takes.
And you both lecture or have lectured on the subject of television. And I did that for a little while in the 2000s for my buddy who taught at Marquette University. He always took a month, maybe 5 weeks off during the semester, and I would come in and teach his class. And what I noticed about this is, and it's probably a big part of this book too, is you're really talking about just different defined periods in time when we talk about what was entertaining us in the moment? Who were the big stars of the day? What was the strategy for a network or for the fall season, for a specific season? It really told me when I was doing a class on television advertising, is I showed the Kool-Aid guy running through the wall from the 70s. These kids were, you know, born in the 90s, and they knew exactly what it was. And I'm like, how is that possible? And they're like, well, it was Family Guy. He's always in Family Guy running through the background. So there's different connections to things from the past that I think everybody has and every generation has.
Yes, and I think that's one of the things we really try to do in the book, is to try to show the highlights of each era and how they frequently flow from one era to the other. So, as you say, the Kool-Aid guy, you know, it could resonate with a later generation. One of the famous things I remember when we were doing the research, and we were researching about the old Sid Caesar program, your show of shows, mm-hmm. you know, the light went on in our head saying, oh, this is Saturday Night Live in the 50s.
Right, right,
and that's what it was, because you frequently have this similar ideas and concepts that keep popping up in different eras,
and they keep popping up because they work.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And one of the things that we also try to do is, you know, just connect the dots, so to speak. You're always going to have people who want to tell a story.
Yeah.
And there are only so many stories you could tell in terms of comedy, drama, sports, etc. And each era embraces it in its own way. Yeah. Broadcasters, yeah. cable, yeah. and now streaming.
It's funny you say that. Like when my kids want to share music with me and it samples a song that I grew up with, and they tell, or it's a remake of a song, I'm like, this is not a new song. A lot of that's very prevalent in television too, Wally, because, you know, you'll be watching something and be like, oh, this is a brand new show. But I'm like, well, it's a reboot, or this is a version of this show that was on in the 1970s or whatever it is. But it always kind of comes back to, not that there's no new ideas, but there's a lot of things over the last 8 decades in television that have kind of seen themselves return.
Well, you know, one of the things that we point out in the new edition, when we're talking about the new CBS series, Ghosts, which, of course, if you know anything about TV, is a U.S. version of a British similar sitcom called Ghosts. And, you know, there's millions of examples of things like that. But what struck me was, you know, in many ways, this is similar to the old 50s TV series Topper, which I remember seeing reruns of as a kid with a talking ghost that only one person can see and hear. And I went back and looked at the background of Topper, and okay, yes, there was the Topper TV series, which was based on a 1940s radio series, mm-hmm. which was based on some 1930s movies from Hollywood, which was based on a 1920 novel that was written. So, you know, you get the things that just keep flowing through and keep showing up in more modern versions.
What makes this the wonderful era of TV to be experiencing is because of streaming, because of cable, because of pre-recorded collections, that we can actually peek into all of the eras of television.
Yeah.
There was an old NBC campaign decades back that said, if you haven't seen it, it's new to you.
That's
what a lot of people are experiencing, is, wow, this is fun. You go, okay, so it is 32 years old. But it's fun because you haven't seen it before.
But now, Wally, when this book first came out in 82, it was really 4 decades maybe of television.
Exactly.
How did it come about?
What happened is, Harry had mentioned that he and I had successfully done a book about the Beatles,
right.
and actually licensed it for a paperback, so it was a success.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, what do we do next?
Yeah.
And we talked about other rock groups and such, and I'm going to give you the whole conference now.
Yeah.
Wally says to Harry, why don't we leave the area of rock completely? Harry says, how about television? Wally says, okay. That was, and the thing is, because we knew how we would tell the story.
Yeah, sure.
It was all about putting context to things we knew a little bit about already, but now it was fleshing it out. And also, frankly, it was something we always wanted to do anyway.
Yeah. I will tell you, I love the grids in here. I love these little, what do you call them? These little vignettes that you have in there.
The date boxes and all?
The date boxes. I mean, when you were thinking about doing the book to begin with, like, what was the first thing you said has to be in here, Wally?
Oh, Basically, the first thing we said was way too much. Oh, yeah, we started with the grids.
Yeah.
And we started with the sense of, we know it's going to be season by season.
Yeah.
We knew that. And that was a very important decision to make, because instead of saying, here's an essay about quiz shows, here's an essay about news, instead is, here is what was happening during that particular era.
Whether puts it in perspective.
Exactly. Yeah. It's either 1955-56 or it's 2021-22. I mean, it is whatever era you want to flip to, you could go to it. And what we're very, very proud of is if you could read this book starting on page one, go all the way to the end, or open it to any chapter, and there'll be a self-contained enough story that we will relate. They can say, that was a good read. Let me read some more.
And by doing it that way, by having a season by season, chapter by chapter approach, you know, after we would write a season's text, we would suddenly say, oh my goodness, we didn't mention X, Y, or Z. How can we not mention X, Y, and Z? It's important, or it will become important in a couple of years. And so we devised, just on the spur of the moment, what we call the date boxes, which are little vignettes, little blurbs that run through each chapter that serve as sort of like a safety valve to say, okay, look, we had to mention this, so we'll get in a little brief mention of it. Or we use it, as I said, to kind of seed the concept of this person or this program that will become important 3, 4, 5 years later, and we'll talk about it then.
But what's really cool about this, too, is, I mean, you know, when people think about television, the dawn of television, they might really back it into the late 40s, like 47, 48, maybe 49, where it was a little bit more. But like 41 is where, you know, television was really getting aggressively tested in different markets and so forth. But the seasons that you start with are 1944. And so that is the first legitimate season, Wally, that you...
I'm laughing at that because we take great delight. When you look at the schedule grid for the fall of 1944, there's a lot of empty spaces in that
there
grid.
There is, which is wild. It's funny, the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports, which I know was on... Yeah, go ahead.
The Gillette Cavalcade of Sports is why we start the grid in 44, because that was... If you know, we always hate to put the word first on anything because there's, you know, a lot of debate over what's first. But Gillette Cavalcade of Sports is generally agreed to be the first successful, long-lasting network television program in America, if you can get all that out. And that ran until 1960. In fact, I remember watching it as a kid. And so that was, we figured, okay, that's where it starts. And we went from there forward.
And one of the things that's really striking in the early 50s is you go, oh, Gunsmoke, a classic, a long-lasting TV Western. Oh, there's this other version of, oh, it's the original version of Gunsmoke. And you realize that's been around multiple years. And then comes the television.
Right.
And so one of the controversies when the TV version came out is, why don't you have the deep-voiced
William Conrad
yeah. as Matt Dillon? And it's because television is not radio. And William Conrad had a killer voice as Matt Dillon. And he would have been okay as Marshall Dillon on TV, and later he would become a star of other TV
yeah.
detective series.
Yeah.
But in terms of when people were looking for the TV version of this radio show, they were picturing John Wayne. They
yeah,
were picturing
right,
someone
right.
who looked like
right.
that. And God bless
theater,
him.
Because it was theater of the mind.
Exactly,
so
theater of the mind. Yeah. You can make Matt Dillon look like whatever you want. When you do TV, the town, the shootouts, the Marshall... They're there. Imagination yeah. has to step aside for what's on the screen.
Wally Pedraza, Carrie Kasseman, the newest edition of their book, Watching TV, is out now, and there's more with them next on 720 WGN. Artist Dave Plyer, 720 WGN. Wally Pedraza, Carrie Kasseman are with me. The newest edition of their book, Watching TV, is out now. So let's talk a little bit about pioneers, because you do mention many studio executives in here and kind of what their vision was and who are the big influential writers, creators, producers of television. If I asked, like, what would you say would be, you know, for like CBS, NBC, that you would find notable in the very beginning, and then we'll talk about the 70s, 80s, 90s.
Well, for CBS would be William Paley, of course, the visionary who continued till the very end of his career, sort of establishing his mark, saying, I'm going to create an archive of TV, not just of CBS. I mean, he was very conscious of the fact that he was one of the pioneers defining what this medium would be. But he wasn't the first. Harry, who was the first?
Well, first. Again, Wally, you know we hate that word first. But you've got to, it's real, the first big giant figure has got to be David Sarnoff. He came over from Russia as an immigrant kid, started working for the Marconi Company as a messenger boy, was receiving signals, supposedly, from the Titanic on wireless when it went down, winds up working for RCA when it begins, is telling his bosses, you've got to get involved in radio. They think he's crazy. Radio becomes successful. He says, you got to get involved in TV. They think he's crazy. And TV comes up. David Sarnoff is considered the father of American television. He was a domineering force in creating American television. There's pluses and minuses of him, as there are with any big character, but he established NBC and made it the big network that it was for many, many, many years.
And then once things were established, you can go over to the creative side, for instance.
Yeah.
And there you see people like Pat Weaver, also staying with NBC,
yeah,
who had these visions.
Tonight.
Exactly. Yeah. Today Show, Tonight Show, et cetera, saying, this is great what we're doing. Let's do more. Let's explore other day parts, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody's locals are filling the time. We want the network to fill the time and, of course, reap the benefit of the commercials as well. And so you have visionaries like that that say, let's take television even further.
And as television evolves... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Harry.
No, I was going to say, and also you got to look at people who are doing more mainstream meat and potatoes stuff. Look at, like, Paul Henning, the creator of The Real McCoys and Beverly Hillbillies and The Green Acres. Aaron Spelling, who filled the television in the 70s with Charlie's Angels, Love Boat, Dynasty, you know, Mod Squad, Beverly Hills 90210. You know, these are people who really had their pulse on the what people wanted to watch and filled up a lot of our screens.
All right, it's Dave Plyer, 720 WGN, the newest edition of Watching TV. How many pages?
600 plus.
600 plus is
who's
out
counting?
Who's counting? We're talking to Wally Podrasik and Harry Castleman. We're talking about pioneers of the day, the early days of television. But when I think of the 70s, I you know, what comes to mind is Fred Silverman. When it comes to the 80s, Brandon Tartikoff. I mean, these were, as television evolved, they were at the helm.
Right. And you have someone like Brandon Tartikoff saying, I know how to make money. I know how to program.
Yeah.
And I'm going to support creativity. Mm-hmm. I mean, so let's figure out a way, you know, this Seinfeld thing.
Yeah.
Let's see if we could figure out, let me borrow a little bit of money from this other project, siphon it over here, and let's give it a shot. Okay, one episode, not so good, but let's work on it.
Yeah.
And that's something that really is telling for a visionary throughout television history. If you know how to do the day in, day out, bread and butter, we're making good money turning out this programming. And then that gives these visionaries the opportunity to say, and let's do something a little bit different.
You know, you mentioned Wally and I did an entire half hour once before on the rural purge that happened. Like, it was on the 50th anniversary. We talked about that. But that was Fred Silverman. Fred came from actually WGN TV at some point in his career and then went over to CBS. And, you know, when I see his interviews on the American Television Academy has some interviews with him.
Yeah.
It's very clear, like, he really just picked it all apart and was going to blow everything up and start over for a completely different generation.
Well, I think Fred Silverman did his, I don't know, master's thesis, whatever, on ABC's primetime programming grid in the 50s.
Wow.
I mean, this is a guy who knew programming backwards and forwards. And that was that classic era in television when he was in charge of CBS, when, you know, it was like a chess match. You know, NBC would move one show from here to there. CBS would counter with this move from that to that. But, you know, you got to give him credit. Fred Silverman was the guy who green-lighted Hill Street Blues before he left NBC. And that was one of, I think, one of the greater shows of the 80s.
And with someone, again, Harry's could have been a good example of the way an executive's vision could let something have the time to develop. And look, what was the description? MTV Cops, when he was doing...
I see what you're saying. In the development stage.
In the development stage and all, when they were doing Miami Vice and all. So there's the idea of, yes, we know how to do this, and we are going to take it to someplace you haven't seen before.
And the rural purge that we were talking about was when Fred said, okay, all this, pretty much everything with the tree.
Everything with the tree is gone.
Is gone. So Beverly Hillbillies, Mayberry, all of that stuff went away.
And the thing is, it was also him as a savvy programmer. When he was doing that as the package of the rural purge, so to speak, a lot of those were getting a little long in the tooth already anyway. Yeah, so to have one fewer season of, say, Hogan's Heroes, or one fewer season of
My Three Sons.
My Three Sons. So what?
He used to talk about My Three Sons with contempt. Like, let's do one more season of the show. We're done. We're putting it, and they would kill it in just a horrible time slot.
Yeah,
that's how they would get rid of stuff.
And the other thing you got to remember about the Rural Purge, which you may have discussed at the time when you did the interview, but a lot of that was in response to the fact that the federal government had, the FCC had mandated the primetime access rule and had chopped a half hour off of primetime as it existed at that time. And so all the networks had to get rid of a half hour a night, pretty much. And so they had to look around and, okay, who are we going to cut? And so a lot of the rural-based stuff wound up getting cut.
There's also influential writers, creators, producers of television. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. I mean, they build an empire, and then first woman executive to run and own a television company.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's really exciting about looking back in the early days. In other words, you have, for technical reasons and personal reasons, Lucy and Desi did not want to do a live from New York situation comedy setting. We want to do it in Hollywood on film and produce it that way.
They thought they were nuts. And we're not paying for it.
So much so that they ended up creating what would be TV from then on, which was, all right, we're going to film something. We, Lucy and Desi, own the property because we fronted the money. And so now, that's how you make money in TV, rerunning it again and again and again.
They also, I always love telling kids, like, I'm like, we're watching Mission Impossible, or we're watching the Untouchables movie, or, you know, we talk about Star Trek. I'm like, you know, this was all Lucy. This was Lucy greenlighting all these shows.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Harry.
No, I was just going to say, if you're trying to think of somebody in the modern vein of that, you have to mention Shonda Rhimes.
Yeah.
Who, was basically took over a good chunk of ABC's primetime schedule, in the 2000s, 2010s, Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder, et cetera, et cetera. And then she, following the way things are changing on TV, switches over to Netflix and begins creating programs for them there under her Shondaland Studios, with like Bridgerton and the series that is on currently, The Residence. So she is one of the great, powerful figures in television today.
I would also say some other ones, maybe early on, and this is probably not a familiar, you could say Dick Wolf, and everybody knows who Dick Wolf is, especially here in Chicago. Yeah. But Roy Huggins, back in the day. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And
Ollie, that's your bread and butter.
Looking at, you go back to Maverick, you go back to the Rockford Files, you go back to, basically, when I say Maverick, I really mean the whole Warner Brothers action-adventure formula. And then, of course, you go to something like The Fugitive. And
that's what I was just looking it up on my phone. I'm like, boy, that sounds familiar. And The Fugitive, by the way, still today, I think, stands up one of the greatest shows on television.
I loved that program. Yeah. I loved it. Yeah. I was a teenager. I was like, beginning to sort of figure out how things work in the world. And I loved David Janssen. And one of the things that just hit me was, you know, here's this guy on the run and he can't really get involved with people and he's, you know, afraid of being captured. And he had this little visual tick where he would, you know, somebody would say something and make him realize he couldn't really hang out there very long. And he would give this little half smile.
Yeah.
And to me, that said it all. You knew this is, I felt so sorry for the guy.
Absolutely. Hunter was another one. 77 Sunset Strip.
Yeah. And the again, what people discovered very early on was viewers like formula.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing.
No.
If you want to have innovation, you need something that would be, as Harry mentioned, the bread and butter, the meat and potatoes. You need something there that you flip it on. That's a fun viewing experience for a half hour, an hour, and I instantly forget it, but that's okay. It served its purpose.
Yeah.
And then the stuff that you want to collect and discuss and see over and over again, those are the special moments that a TV does provide as well.
Wally Podrazek, Harry Castleman, the newest edition of their book, Watching TV, is out now. And there's more with them next on 720 WGN. All right, we are talking in studio with Wally Podrazek. Harry Castleman is also with me. We're talking about the newest edition of their book, Watching TV. 600 pages, about how many pounds? It's a massive book, but it's anything and everything you would want to know.
I think it's 4.5 pounds, something like that.
Hey, but this is the first edition available as an ebook, so you can get it.
Oh, okay. All right. Don't have to carry it around. Now, see, like these type of books, I just want to be able to page through.
Well, actually, so do we. Yeah. So we were so happy, actually, at Syracuse University Press, which is the publisher of this book, said we want a book version and we want an ebook version. And we were thrilled to do both.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, the students at University of Illinois Chicago, or in my classes, have been lobbying me for 10 years to get ebook version. So this is right up their alley. But we look, we're old fashioned. We love print.
So you talk about late night television in here as well, and I just put together the synopsis for an exhibit that the Museum of Broadcast Communications, we are going to do in the fall. I chair it. Wally's very involved in it as well, on the centennial of Johnny Carson, which is this October. And it's also the 75th anniversary of late night television. So there's a massive, massive story to tell here. And, you know, even though, and I was talking to Johnny Carson's nephew about this, that even though Johnny's show was just a walk through American history from every single angle, you know, kids today don't know who Johnny Carson is, but when I played a clip of something, they recognized the clip because it is part of American history, as I said. Late night television was 1950. I know everyone credits Broadway Open House, but there was a Faye Emerson show that on in the very beginning.
Harry, why don't you go with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, looking at television as being the follow-through on network radio. Network radio had, which largely had the same kind of primetime hours that early television had. Network radio also had some late-night programming, and it tended to be musical variety. You'd have little, you know, from the, you know, Cafe So-and-So in Manhattan. Here's So-and-So, Vincent Lopez and his orchestra. And they would do that. And so you would have people like Perry Como with the Chesterfield Supper Club,
right.
I think began in 49 on NBC as a late night. Again, a late night being after 11 o'clock Eastern, 10 o'clock Central. Faye Emerson did a late show. And, of course, one of the more obscure and arcane late night programs was called The Continental on CBS, which was a bizarre 15-minute show with this Italian-American who was trying to show how he was so suave and sophisticated, speaking to this unseen woman who comes into his apartment. And that, of course, is the basis for the famous Saturday Night Live skit with Christopher Walken that shows up in the 90s and in the 2000s.
Wow. Yeah, those are the connections that are absolutely being made in this book. It still stuns me that could we not come up with enough content to fill 30 minutes? There was a lot of 15-minute shows.
Oh, yeah. When you're talking about the way television through streaming and such is now, when you say, wow, there are so many little bits here, little bits there. Well, that's how TV started.
I mean,
an hour show, true, that was a big commitment.
Actually, radio, there was a lot of 15-minute shows, too,
yeah.
Back in the day. I know when Carson started, It was more than a 90-minute show.
Oh, yeah, because he had that. He actually started at the 15-minute mark, because back then, just to put historical perspective on there, you had the local news going for 15 minutes, right. Not yet for 30. Right. And so you'd have that first 15 minutes. And after a while, Johnny was saying, I don't need to be here for this.
One of the contract negotiations was Ed. It was probably Ed and doing like the, you know, more
than
locally.
That's exactly what it was. Johnny would come on at 11:30, 10:30 Central, and after Ed kind of filled, and the band filled for 15 minutes.
That's wild. I mean, we're talking about 2 hours of late night
television. That's a lot.
And then he went to 3 days a week for an hour, right? I mean, that's just how it goes. I love that.
And they used to show reruns on Saturday nights, late night on NBC. And then they said, you know, why don't we try to utilize this time frame for a different kind of programming, and they took off this Saturday rerun of Tonight and stuck in this thing called Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Which meant, of course, that there were discussions with Carson beforehand saying, so we're going to do this. You're going to sign off on that. Yeah, okay.
What I know about that, too, is he felt like it was a little bit of overkill of him, like 6 days a week for an hour and a half a night. That's a lot. That's a lot of TV exposure for sure. And then late night has evolved so much. You know, we talk about, I remember seeing an interview with Carson, which they're rare to see, but talking about the fact that, you know, what do you think about Mike Wallace, Chicago's own Mike Wallace, talking to him on 60 Minutes and said, you know, what about politics? You know, you tell jokes about the politicians, but you really don't focus. He goes, that's not what I'm there for. That I don't need to do that. Like, this is the end of people's day. I want to entertain them. I want them to laugh. And I'm not there for serious issues. And look where that is today. You can't escape it.
Yeah, it does at times make you nostalgic for the way it used to be. Not because you don't want to be engaged in the news, but it's like, look, enough.
Yeah.
Let's have a couple of chuckles. And so that's why when you look at some of the current late night lineups, yes, there's a strong political bent in them, but there's also a strong absurdist bent to it.
Yeah.
So it's not just we're going to tell jokes. We're going to tell jokes that are almost from another planet.
Yeah.
And so, because that's what you want to do, is you want to leave this planet for a little bit, come back and land, and then we'll see you again in the morning.
Shameless plug, The Tonight Show, actually the Johnny Carson era of The Tonight Show, airs weeknights on Antenna TV, so you still can get that.
Oh, and in fact, that's part of the fun of the cable offerings and such, over-the-air reruns like that, is you are transported back to another era. This is the best time to be watching television.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the subject lines and the chapters in this book. And it's really like, you know, in the 1950s, what's my crime? CBS and RFD, you got the big event, Gleam in the Eye, Aftermath.
Oh, we had a lot of fun putting those titles together. And we have a special little feature on our website, watchingtv.org. If you go to that, there's a special little thing you can click on, and you can read the background story of where we got all those, how we came up with a lot of those titles, or where we got a number of them also.
I love that. I love that. And then, you know, I mean, we talk about everybody watched the same shows together, and that era, of course, is long gone. But, you know, when you think about why we resonate with these shows from the 60s or the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, maybe the early 80s, maybe into Cheers and maybe Seinfeld and maybe a little bit of Friends. You know, we all watched Gilligan's Island 7,000 times. And I will tell you, I think I turned it on recently. It's not a great show, but it was in our face, and you could get away with doing two or three seasons and 40 episodes a season. And that's why it was in syndication. And that's why we saw them so many times. Not everything stands up, but what a different time that we live today, where, you know, you could just sit down to dinner with a group of people and talk about the most common shows that you watched the night before or the week before, you following this, following that. Now you sit down and talk to people. There's shows I've never heard of, half these shows that people are talking about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the biggest change, of course, in television, is scarcity. Of course, in the traditional days growing up, you had the three networks. Maybe you had PBS. Eventually, you had Fox. But nowadays, of course, it's a completely different world. There's great diversity in offerings, but that makes the art task, writing this, the updates in this book, more challenging. But I think we're up to the challenge, and we have to synthesize and plow through all the myriad of offerings that are available now and still come up with the same kind of interesting story that all connects together and flows.
And that's one of the functions. Remember you were talking about those little date boxes?
Yeah.
More than ever, those help us to tackle the panoply of programming that's out there.
I would say when I'm at dinner with friends, instead of talking about shows we're all watching together, I'm literally taking notes of shows I need to watch. Like, they'll say, well, you're going to love this show. And I'm like, what is that stream? Like, where is that on? Like, where do I find that show? And then, did you try this one? And there's this new John Hamm one. This is about, it's really weird. It's just he lost his job and blah, blah, blah. John Hamm's back on, and he's not really back on television. He's back on the air, I guess you could say. But I end up writing a lot of notes and then trying them out. And if I like them, then you start binge watching. And that's the other thing, too, about television these days, right, is you're not waiting. You know, Batman, when it was on the 60s, was on two nights. So it was teasing Wednesday and Thursday nights. You know, same bat time, same bat channel. You watch it tomorrow, or you waited till the next week to see your favorite show. I mean, right now, I mean, you could watch an entire season in one sitting. It's different, the way we experience things.
But one of the really good things is that in your own circle, whatever circle that may be, you'll find that you do find your favorites and you do find the ones that you want to talk with someone else about. It's just that you have to seek out your fellow TV watchers. You have to seek out your fellow Game of Thrones fans, for instance. There are folks who say, I never watch that. And folks will say, no, I'm watching Ghosts instead.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to talk about those. You'll find your circle. And once you find them, you will do exactly what they used to do back in the 50s. You'll talk about your favorites.
What I love is I get to introduce to my kids, which I've done for years, is we will binge watch, not binge watch, but over the summer, I'll introduce them to a show I grew up with. And watch those for a little bit, too, which is a lot of fun. Wally Pedraza, Carrie Castleman, this newest edition of their book, I'm going to say 70 pounds, Watching TV is out now. I'm telling you, folks, if you love television, grab this book. Watching TV is the title. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Oh.